February 11th, 2020. 2019 was a very busy year for the Capital Investment Committee. We're glad to be back. And thank you for being here on a timely basis. After we conclude our meeting, I ask anyone that wants to stay, they may stay because I have a few presentations to make as a result of our meetings with the hometown people in their hometowns. As I said probably a couple of times before, when I was called to consider being chair of the Capital Investment Committee, it was a Saturday night. Late November, after the elections, and speaker called on about 8 o'clock on Saturday night, and she said, "Will you consider being chair of the Capital Investment Committee?" And at that time, I thought, "Holy cow." I said, "Are we going to have money? Lots of money?" And she couldn't promise anything at that time. And I talked about the number of committee meetings and so forth that asked mostly questions, and she didn't have very many answers. And then she gave me till 8 o'clock the next morning to call her back. And so I did, but in those 12 hours in between, I never gave a thought to bonding tours. You know, sometimes you kind of blank things out of your past life, and it doesn't sit in the front of your brain because it wasn't a great experience in the past. And so I forgot. But then came our caucuses where we met and our retreats and so forth. And I met various people that said, "I'm going to sign up for, I signed up for your committee because I love those bonding tours." And I thought, oh my gosh. But I too love the bonding tours. And I thank every one of you that were able to come, even if it was only in your own district for your own project. I appreciate that because that shows sincerity and that you know the hometown people too. And that's really, really important. And I'm sorry that every single person that's sitting in the audience didn't get to come on all the tours. But your faces are remembered at the tourist stops that we were at. And I know that committee members have jobs in real life. And it's not easy to be a part-time legislator when you're a real-life teacher or you're a real-life gas station owner or you're a real-life car salesman or whatever you may be. And so we have to balance. But on every single tour that we have, 17 days of touring in the fall, September, October, November, days of touring. We got on the bus at 7:15, ready to go. And we never got off the bus but one time. Before 8:45, when we could walk into our hotel room. And on every one of those tours, and on one of, every one of those, we had over 50% of the committee members in attendance. And so that's really pretty great. And so we know these projects, and we're ready to have last-minute instructions about how my projects changed because... But we're ready to format a bill and to hear the governor's recommendations. But keeping in mind that the people of Minnesota have spoken to all of us and talked to us about their needs. We went northwest, southwest, southeast, northeast, metro, central. We went all over the place for almost 3,500 miles. We saw dumps. We saw white wastewater. We saw flooded grasslands. We saw the Jefferson hieroglyphs, which was the very best. We saw them because when I did accept that position, I told Jenny Nash, whether they've got a request in or not, we're going to stop at the Historical Society's prairie hieroglyphs. I'm going to see those because on the bonding tours, I do remember, we just drove by. Never, ever stopped. And I always thought, I want to see those. And as it turned out, it was indeed the very best thing we did. Maybe because they weren't asking for any money. They had already gotten it. But Representative Lilly's, you know, contemplating his new hobby, archery, because of that stop. Or sword fighting or something. So we're ready to go on that. We saw a total of 236 presentations. And that were people that came on the bus and talked. We didn't just nap or eat. We listened. We learned. And so we're thankful to the people who made accommodations in their real life to tell their story. But there are more stories to come. But first of all, we're going to hear today's agenda, which is Commissioner France, Ms. Connor, who's going to tell us what the governor's recommendations are. And why governor's recommending those things. And we'll put our priorities or our thoughts aside and listen up to those projects and see how they're cupped into buckets of different kinds of funding, different approach than we might have heard before. So welcome to the committee, Mr. Commissioner France, Ms. Connor.
Good morning, Madam Chair. Good morning, members of the committee. I'm so happy to be here today. Thank you for the opportunity to talk about the governor's plan. And as you make quite clear, it is an opportunity for us to look at different approaches. Elizabeth Connor is with me. She's one of our team leads at the Minnesota Management Budget Office. And so she's going to help me with this presentation. So as Chair Murphy mentioned, my name is Myron Franz, Commissioner of Minnesota Management and Budget. This is actually one of the favorite parts of this job for me, and that is presenting the governor's recommendation for his local jobs and local projects plan. But before I get into the details, I also want to begin by acknowledging the hard work of the many Minnesotans that prepared and submitted their projects for consideration and who were available and responded to our questions. This was an iterative process. These items were posted and we reviewed them. We visited them like you all did. And through that process, we now have these projects before us. And we think the commitment by the local officials and the state officials is really quite impressive. I mean, we owe them a thank you for their willingness to improve their communities and engage in this process. As we review the governor's plan, I do want to make it clear, though, that this is a list from the people and the officials of Minnesota. It is not the governor's list. We're relying on people submitting their request. And second, I do also want to recognize the hard work of my colleagues at MMB who worked tirelessly throughout this process. As you'll see, the number of projects, the magnitude of the request has gone up dramatically, and we still have the same number of staff at MMB, so there's a lot of work to do. The third, I want to recognize, as Chair Murphy did, the hard work of the committee in its review of the projects, including your site trips and long days across the state. As we all know, that process, that visitation and the touring really provides you with the opportunity to understand projects that you cannot do simply by looking at the paper. But I also want to recognize the leaders and the state leaders before us who, before our time, invested in many of these projects. As you know, many of the projects that we're recommending investing asset preservation in were projects that were committed a long time ago by state leaders and local leaders. And what we're trying to do is support those original capital investments and make sure they continue to provide the resources that we want. It's really our time now to take care of what they've already provided in many cases to continue our investment in our communities. But let's start about the process. I would like Ms. Connor to kind of start off with the process and describe how we went through this.
Excuse me, before you start, do you want us to interrupt or do you want us to wait till you're all done?
Well, that's a really good question, Madam Chair. I'm torn on that. I actually think it's probably best if we just ask questions as we go along. That way we're right on topic and people can see what we're going to. And if I'm going to get to something in detail, I'll just ask people to wait until we get to that point. But let's just go ahead and take questions if that's okay.
And if members of the committee will indicate that you have a question, Mr. Lee and Ms. Nash will make note of that, and we will stop at appropriate times.
Great. Thank you.
Welcome, Ms. Connor.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Good morning, Madam Chair and committee members. My name is Liz Connor. I'm an executive budget coordinator at Minnesota Management and Budget, and I'm going to speak with you a bit about the process that we went through at MMB for the 2020 capital budget cycle. We started the 2020 capital budget process at MMB nearly 1 year ago by asking state agencies, the University of Minnesota, Minnesota State, cities and counties to submit their proposals. And our first glimpse into the infrastructure needs that exist across the state came last summer when MMB published capital requests from state agencies and local governments that totaled more than $5 billion. This is a 60% increase from the request that we received at MMB just 2 years ago. We also learned throughout the process that Minnesotans are fiercely proud of their communities and they want to partner with the state to invest in those communities. MMB worked with the governor and his staff to ensure that the capital budget was developed using a more inclusive and transparent process. Governor Walz kicked off his review process by traveling to communities across the state on a bonding tour to see firsthand the needs of local communities. MMB staff spent more than 100 hours traveling, touring submitted projects, and meeting with Minnesotans. And we want to thank, as Commissioner Franz said, the community leaders, legislative leaders, and Minnesotans that welcomed us. For the first time, we created an online space to collect public feedback. Minnesotans were able to tell us about their community needs by commenting on local government investments, projects up for consideration. The comments are all visible on MMB's website. Governor Walz, his staff, and MMB reviewed this input as we developed the plan. Some examples of the comments we received include about the Batcher Block, Opera House restoration, and Staples. I have been a business owner and served on various economic development boards. This is the one project that will make the largest impact, not only for the city of Staples, but for the entire region of Greater Minnesota that I have seen. A comment about the Blazing Star State Trail. This has been a project that I've heard about my entire life. I'm 19 now, and it's still not completed. I think finishing the Blazing Star Trail and building the bridge in addition to it would be an important element, not just to the Albert Lea area, but to Freeborn County as a whole, and the Bloomington Center for the Arts. I am a member of the Medalist Band, which is already one of the best community bands in the nation. Having a dedicated rehearsal space and concert hall would be a dream come true for us, allowing us to reach yet a higher level. Bloomington's and Minnesota's commitment to the arts is one of the reasons I am proud to live here. While developing this proposal, we evaluated all projects based on factors such as readiness, urgency, and commitment to Governor Walz and Lieutenant Governor Flanagan's One Minnesota priorities, such as how they would support children and families and creating a more equitable Minnesota. There's no denying that the state is facing an ever-increasing volume of infrastructure needs to support the services our neighbors expect and deserve. When you combine state agency and local government requests, the total is over $5 billion in need. This does not include the additional projects that did not submit requests in the governor's process or projects that the legislature might propose. We are not suggesting a $5 billion bonding bill, however, but the sheer number of requests is indicative of the level of need and reflective of the difficult choices the governor and you legislators face while trying to prioritize funding.
So let's talk a little bit about the real needs. You know, as the governor said, the plan is more than a total number. It is the collection of the worthy projects that make up the projects from across the state. Our goal is to make sure that we include the right projects in this proposal and that we work with the legislature to come up with a bonding bill that really serves all of Minnesota. But you can see from this slide that the state is facing a monumentous and real needs related to infrastructure. The state's existing facilities backlog continues to grow statewide and must be addressed. The longer we wait, costs will increase and the challenge will become exponentially worse. As you can see from these three categories, we have $1.7 billion in backlog of asset preservation in state-owned facilities, $2 billion at the University of Minnesota, and $1 billion at the Minnesota State facilities. And it's also staggering if you want to consider the $4 billion in construction repairs that need for nearly 1,000 local water infrastructure projects that will be needed over the next 20 years. It once again points to the fact that we need to make progress every year on addressing these infrastructure needs. And some of these infrastructure needs we simply can't see. The communities really cannot grow and thrive without a basic water infrastructure. And as you all know, there's a significant shortage of affordable housing units across the state, not just the metro area. Experts estimate that there's about another 300,000 housing units will be needed by the year 2030. I would like just to kind of go through an overview of the governor's local jobs and projects plan. So as you know, on January the 15th, in accordance with the statute, Governor Walz and Lieutenant Governor Flanagan announced their $2.03 billion general obligation bond package. Now, we took a lot of care to build that and invest in communities across the states, but I do want to mention that as we go through this, I'll take it through a high level, and throughout the course of the next several weeks, you'll have opportunities from the state agency leaders, from the local project leaders to come and explain in detail their projects. So I'll try to give you an overview today. So the first slide, really a category I want to talk about that Chair Murphy mentioned, that we put this in the different kind of buckets or categories, and that's safe and affordable housing. This safe and affordable housing will be used as a statewide resource to address the shortage of affordable housing units. It includes an historic $200 million in housing infrastructure bonds. The largest component of the $76 million in general obligation bonds that you see on the right is $60 million for the Public Housing Rehabilitation Program. This is at the Minnesota Housing Finance Agency. This preserves existing public housing and keeps it safe and healthy for residents. This level of funding is estimated to improve about 6,000 homes. This funding will support some of our most vulnerable Minnesotans. Nearly 66% of households in public housing are seniors or people with disabilities, while 33% are families with children. The $200 million in appropriation bonds for housing infrastructure will support housing, preserve existing housing, and senior housing. Minnesota Housing typically receives 3 times more requests than they have funding for. We also know that this recommendation will leverage private investment in the 10-year history of the Housing Infrastructure Bond Program. $191 million in awards have generated over $380 million in total development costs. So once again, the power of leveraging state investments is seen in the housing area. In the water quality and infrastructure.
Wait, Commissioner, why appropriation bonds and not GO bonds?
Great question. General obligation bonds, Madam Chair and members, are reserved for borrowing under the state's constitution for publicly owned facilities and have to have a public purpose. In the case of housing and some other projects I'll mention, some of these do not involve situations where the state or the local unit of government will own the property when it's all said and done. There's mixed use activity, some private use. So when we involve a private use in a bonding situation, in terms of ownership, we have to then use appropriation bonds instead of the general obligation bonds. So that's a public ownership restriction that we have.
Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Commissioner Franz. How much more is the interest rate with the appropriation bond?
Madam Chair, Representative, the interest rate differential between general obligation bonds and appropriation bonds obviously varies on the market, but it can be as much as 0.5% or maybe 1%, depending upon the market. So there's a little bit of guesswork there, but it's anywhere from 0.5% to 1% increased cost for an appropriation bond.
And one more.
Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Commissioner Franz Emmen, the $276 million package, I think you said 6,000 homes. Is that correct?
I think I said 600 homes, Madam Chair, Representative.
Okay, so.
Did I? It is 6,000. Yes, I'm sorry.
All right, so that's how many homes we'd get out of the 276? 276 million? I mean, that seems.
That's in Madam Chair and Representative, and that's one of the ways that we estimate the number of homes that money will touch, but it will also be involved in developing new opportunities as well.
I'm just wondering, Madam Chair, how many housing units we get out of $276
million? Ms. Connor.
Madam Chair, Representative Erdahl, as the Commissioner pointed out, the general obligation bonds will preserve about 6,000 units. Appropriation bonds for housing infrastructure, the Housing Finance Agency has estimated that it might be as many as 1,800 homes that are created or improved. So a total of over, 7,000 to 8,000, possibly.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Continue, Commissioner.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, let's talk about water quality and infrastructure. This is a $300 million package, of which $293 million is in general obligation bonds. This is really an historic investment, and we believe it's really demanded because of the need to be resilient in climate issues and also the management of our water resources. And Governor Walz and I had the opportunity to inspect the Minnesota Central Storm Tunnel a month or so ago and to see firsthand what the infrastructure is like when you go beneath the street level. And it's clear that some of these large infrastructure projects are major undertakings, both from our large cities like Minneapolis, but also from many of our smaller cities. In many cases, these small cities simply don't have the population base to support any increased fees that would be required for this project. This plan includes, as I mentioned, $293 million in general obligations, a lot of which, $200 million of this, goes to the Public Facilities Authority Program. I think many of you are aware of the Public Facilities Authority Program. This provides low-interest loans and grants for clean water and drinking water infrastructure across Minnesota that are based on a priority list that have been developed by the Department of Health and the Pollution Control Agency. Communities that have water infrastructure projects on these lists have the greatest economic, health, and environmental needs for state assistance. And so we think this historic investment in the Public Facilities Authority is critical for addressing the water quality needs and the infrastructure needs around the state. If you look at the governor's higher education.
Excuse me. Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Commissioner Franz on wastewater infrastructure. In the LCCMR, there's a proposal to fund $1.5 million of the Environmental Trust Fund for wastewater infrastructure grants. With the healthy allocation in the governor's bonding recommendation, does the governor support, does the governor feel it's sufficient to have the general obligation bonds pay for that traditional source of revenue and that the Environmental Trust Fund is not appropriate for funding wastewater infrastructure grants?
Madam Chair, Representative, I will tell you that we, because of overall needs, we obviously had to draw the line somewhere in terms of this particular package. And I wouldn't want to say at this point that we would not support other contributions from the LCMR. I think our approach has really been to support that there's a need there. We know there's a need. And this is one way to address that. If there are other ways that we can put additional funding into this water infrastructure program, we would be supportive of that as well. It's as you know, Representative, it's a growing need, and so we're happy to continue to look at other ways to support this program too.
Thank you.
Please go on. Thank you, Madam Chair. Let's talk about higher education. This is another big package. It's $448 million in total. $447 million of it are general obligation bonds. We kicked off the governor kicked off his statewide touring process at the University of Minnesota at the Institute of Child Development. I know that this group, I think, was there as well. And as many of you know, that's just a nation-leading program at the University of Minnesota with a less-than-nation-leading facility. And that facility is by any stretch, below what we would expect of that kind of a facility. And we want to really be supportive of the university to continue to attract and maintain a nation-leading program like that. We also went to the Anoka Ramsey County Community College, and where we announced this package. They obviously have some many needs at the University of Minnesota and Minnesota State. So this plan, in terms of the $447 million, is really going to be used to upgrade classrooms, to reflect new ways of learning and teaching, improve support services for students, promote accessibility, energy efficiency, and of course, my favorite, the asset preservation component of this package. These projects also include about $40 to $41 million in user finance bonds at Minnesota State. I know the members of this community had an opportunity to view a number of projects in this area, both at the University of Minnesota and at Minnesota State. And as you know, one of the things that we're doing at the University of Minnesota in the Child Institute development is that there's groundbreaking research going on there. And in addition to the research that's going on, you need really updated facilities to monitor and have these tests conducted in that facility. And the current facility is way, way below what they need to in order to retain their world-class faculty. So we're hoping that this assessment of the University of Minnesota, but what their needs are by Minnesota State, will help all of us recognize the need to continue to invest in our overall higher education facilities. I think they've done a great job over the years in showing what their needs are and how their needs are growing every year. And we really believe that we need to make a commitment. I think, Frank, we should make a commitment every year to do asset preservation when it comes to the University of Minnesota, Minnesota State, and a lot of state programs. Asset preservation doesn't go away. One of the things I learned in particular from the University of Minnesota and Minnesota State was the way that they planned for these upgrades. I mean, when you're a facilities manager at one of these colleges or universities, you know that you have assets that are really in need. You may have a leaky roof over in one part of the campus, or you may have a situation where a foundation is failing, or whatever it might be in terms of the building. You have to maintain a schedule. You need to know that you're going to get some money every year to address some of these needs, because once you get one thing done, then the next thing on the campus comes up on the next list. And they need to really plan thoughtfully so that we don't have a major failure in any one of these institutions. So it's a really great opportunity to support higher education for our students around the state.
Representative Wolgamott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Commissioner, I want to echo your sentiment that I would like to see this committee have more sustained funding for asset preservation or higher learning institutions. I represent the campus community of St. Cloud State and St. Cloud Technical Community College. And to go with this herky-jerky, oh, hopefully we get it done every 2 years. We can't do it every year because tradition is that we just don't do bonding bills because that's an odd-numbered year, so you've got to wait. That is really doing a disservice to our higher learning institutions. So I want you to know that I share that sentiment, and committee members, I hope we take that seriously as we do planning for bonding in the years to come. Thank you, Commissioner. Thank you, Madam Chair.
On that point, Commissioner, on the asset preservation, the HEPR stuff, that certainly there's a need every year. So did your team talk about that with the two systems on what we could do and the fairness of the division of the amount of money to the various campuses?
Madam Chair, you know, great question. I think one of the things that when we talked about the need that they've, as we mentioned in that slide before, University of Minnesota has a $2 billion backload and back history, and Minnesota State has about $1 billion, I think. So as we talked about that, it is difficult to know how to allocate those resources around all those institutions. One of the things I know that the Minnesota State goes through a very slow and arduous process to make sure they get information from all of their campuses, from all the university and college presidents, to so they can make that decision on a macro basis, understanding where all those needs need to go. And they had a really long list of individual campuses that needed particular help. We actually decided to resolve that by funding all of the campus requests because we felt they were all worthy of having that kind of being singled out like that. But the higher education asset preservation, what's the R stand for? I've forgotten. HEPR.
Repair.
That in and of itself is, and I think sometimes we don't realize how much that money gets spread around all the campus locations too. The project list that the University of Minnesota has, and also the one that Minnesota State has, are major projects at local campuses. But the HEPR money goes all over the entire campus structure, and so they decide on a smaller basis, do they need a new HVAC system in a particular location or some other kind of window treatment it might be. So their number one priority is always the HEPR money, is they need that money to be able to have the flexibility to move around the system and address these short-term needs that could turn into really a long-term problem. So, you know, we're saving money by spending that HEPR money today rather than 2 years from now. To the representative's point, if we can keep that money flowing on a regular basis, we can avoid some long-term, really major changes.
Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Commissioner Franz, now, as I understand the process, what the higher ed institutions are saying is that over the next 2 years, these are the projects we would like to see done. And as I understand it, work is happening each of the 2 years, correct?
Madam Chair, Representative, over the course of the next 2 years, yes, they'll be, and they're also, you know, continuing to use the money that was allocated before. But yes, they're ongoing projects, and they'll be used throughout this next 2 year process. And but many of these, the vast majority of all these, are pretty shovel ready, in the sense that I think they'll have them under construction and underway pretty quick. In part because we didn't do an asset preservation bill last year. And so these things have been teed up for a while, so they're ready to go. And in many, many cases, I would say that for a lot of the projects on this list, there are many, many projects that are shovel-ready and ready to go right away, including the university and Minnesota State.
Commissioner, as I look at various spreadsheets and comparisons, including House File 2591, which passed out of this committee last spring and is in Ways and Means Committee at this time. But even looking at that, it seems to me that we have, the legislature traditionally has a stronger point of view that HEPR and upkeep of our state college system and our University of Minnesota system is vitally important, and there should be a big chunk of money in every bill for that. But as we toured various agencies, and we're going to hear from the agencies following in the following weeks here, or committee meetings, in the following committee meetings, as we toured various agencies and asked for their asset preservation, it doesn't seem to me historically that the legislature has had as much of a commitment to preserving those assets. And somehow or another, how has your team talked about addressing that situation in that agency budgets don't lead to so much preservation of roofs and furnaces and laboratories and various things, and yet when the committee that's finance committees that have an agency sees that those agencies aren't given extra money for preservation on a regular basis, what part of their balloons have little holes in them?
Well, Madam Chair, it's a really good point. I mean, once again, it goes to the problem of not maintaining sort of a consistent support, because if, in fact, a major failure occurs in a building that, you know, safety and people's ability to work is threatened, then we will have to spend current dollars. We have some small monies available for emergencies. For example, this building, how many years ago was it that the water broke in here? And it's been several years, but we had to come up with some money to fix the state office building after that water cascaded down the different floors. And so that money, if we don't do the regular projects and give state agencies the same opportunity to build up asset preservation dollars and keep ahead of the failures, then things like what happened here at the state office building are going to occur. So we have some small monies available for emergencies, but generally, sometimes state agencies have to take money out of their general budget to fix these immediate problems, because if you've got a leaky roof, you have to fix it. So that, to us, the need to invest like we do for the Minnesota State and University of Minnesota, that same need exists for the state agencies. And if we don't maintain this building and other buildings, I mean, this, with all due respect to this building, it needs a major overhaul. I mean, I love the building, right, and the people in it, but it needs a major overhaul. And we just have to, yeah, thank you. We've got to do that. And so we keep putting it off, and maybe next year we'll have another major water event. Centennial is another office building. So we've got major assets, too, that we need to address at some point. I know the problem with state agencies is it becomes a little bit more politically dicey to do that sometimes. It's not as much fun to put money in state buildings, but they have the same needs that the universities and the colleges do, too.
And they employ people from the hometowns all across the state.
They need to be, Madam Chair. They need to be safe, warm, and dry, and
up to date.
And up to date, yes.
Thank you. But before we leave the university state system things, I want to comment and share with you that our tours to the University of Minnesota and to all the state college system buildings that we attended and visited, all the programs that we visited, were very inspiring to us in the sense of the commitment that the students had, the commitment that the faculty had to delivering their missions to the students, and the students from every walk of life and every age group that's possible. We met some of them along the way. And every single visit that we had was inspiring to us in the sense that they were trying to show us how important important this interlude in their lives were to their whole lives and what they were going to do with their hopes and dreams and what they were learning because of the opportunities that were given to them by the investment the state was making. And coincidentally, Anoka Ramsey was our first stop. And in the state system and the Normandale was our last stop. And Normandale had the most up-to-date building for nursing, programming for nursing. And in our first stop at Anoka Ramsey, that was at least a 30-year-old investment that we were seeing the students making do at, and they needed much improvement. And they were putting up with having to move the furniture around from one program to another program, so two or three times during the day so that they could make use of that space all day long. And they were doing it willingly and with the same commitment of, we are so lucky to have this opportunity to be working in this mess, because they were going to go out and they were going to get a job that was going to pay them $3-4 more dollars an hour, $5 an hour more than what they had had when they walked into the room. And you saw it in the faculty that was delivering the statements, and you saw it in the students that were learning and the people that were picking up. You saw it all over. And so the two systems are so vitally tied and connecting to the people of their regions. And everybody's happy to be learning in those systems. And we were inspired. The committee mentioned at those evening wrap-ups that we had how committed and how wonderful that these two systems are operating at such high levels and serving the people so very, very well. And you can pass that on to whoever you want.
Well, Madam Chair, thank you for mentioning that. I think both the University of Minnesota and Minnesota State have realized their best salespeople are their students. I mean, they were always there at every location that we went to. And one thing I was struck by was at the chemistry undergraduate teaching building at the University of Minnesota. And as you know, that building needs to be redone. It has been redone in forever. And I think they're going to demolish and put in a new facility. But when the students were there, some of the teaching assistants were there along with the faculty, they made such a point out of, like you mentioned, that they're really happy to be and honored to be part of this process, but they were there to make sure that the next several classes got a better facility than they did. Their willingness to be committed to saying not only that what they got was great, but they wanted to pass on, especially like in the chemistry teaching facility, they wanted to pass on that opportunity for so many students to go through that program, which is a lot, and a lot of majors have chemistry as part of it. So I was impressed by their willingness to think about the next several classes down the road, too.
It was just inspiring, like I said, inspiring. I did misuse the word, I should have said health care facilities for both Normandale and Anoka Ramsey, because it was a lot more than nursing, but it was for several different missions that they have under health care.
Yeah, Madam Chair, I was so impressed by the students at Anoka Ramsey that I went out there with our team. It must have been the summer sometime, August, because it was hot. It was August. And really thought the governor should see that one. So he came out a little bit later on to announce part of the package. And the students were so excited that we were coming back that they gave me an Anoka Ramsey sweatshirt, which is really nice. Of course, I paid $35 for it. But it was a nice gesture they were so excited the fact that the state policy leaders, they knew that we would be dealing with their program and trying to decide how can we help that nursing program get better space, better teaching facilities. So their excitement was quite evident. Thank you.
Thank you. Please go on.
So let's move on to public safety and asset preservation. This is a big package. It's $857 million. 673 of this package is in general obligation bonds. Now, in the future, you're going to hear from Commissioner Harrington and Commissioner Anderson Kelleher talk about some of their public safety and part of the asset preservation package. But one, we also included in this package $172 million in trunk highway bonds supported by the Trunk Highway Fund. Now, we decided to include the Trunk Highway Fund projects in this particular package. And let me see my notes here. We wanted to make sure that we felt that the bonding bill should not use trunk highway bonds in general as a Band-Aid to approach to fix our state highways. We believe that we only wanted to use the trunk highway bonds where they're limited to rail grade separations, a facilities program at MnDOT, and one local flood hazard mitigation project. So our use of trunk highway bonds was specifically limited to these three areas, not as a general approach. We think a transportation package should deal with the overall transportation issues. We'll talk also about some local highway and local bridge programs, too, but our use of trunk highway bonds was limited in this package.
Would you repeat that one more time, please?
Sure. We utilized $172 million funds in this particular package, and that was designed to really only address the rail grade separation program. And we have a facilities capital program at MnDOT that required some general some funds, trunk highway funds, and also one local flood hazard mitigation project. This was not for general trunk highway fund transportation matters. We felt that should be handled in a transportation package. We do have, as I mentioned, we have money supporting about $100 million supporting local roads and 115 in local bridges. But $105 million in local bridges. And then, as I mentioned, we have the rail separation program, which is over $100 million. So those are the ways that we tried to address local roads, local bridges, rail separations, MnDOT general obligation building projects, and flood hazards. Otherwise, our bonding bill was not geared toward trying to solve all the transportation infrastructure issues.
And on the local bridges, do you have a list?
MnDOT has a, Madam Chair, MnDOT has a list of what is in line for that particular, I don't have that in front of me, but Commissioner Anderson Kelleher will have that available for you.
Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Commissioner Franz, the flood hazard mitigation, is that the one through the DNR, or is this another specific project?
Madam Chair, Representative, it's the Albert Lea. It's a particular project in Albert Lea.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Erdahl.
And then there is the, Henderson has a flooding problem, too. Do you have that in the bill?
Madam Chair and Representative, this is not specifically in this bill. It needs there. That's one of those. We have to determine the eligibility of that particular project for one of the state programs.
Yeah, Madam Chair.
Representative Erdahl.
My impression was that was also needing trunk highway bonds.
Madam Chair, Representative, that's true. Part of that could use trunk highway funds for part of it, but it could also use some local flood mitigation money as well.
Madam Chair.
Representative Erdahl.
Thank you. We'll discuss that more.
Madam Chair, we could go make a visit, too, if you'd like.
Please go on.
You know, when I spoke to this committee 2 years ago, the state's deferred maintenance backlog is about $1.5 billion. And as I showed on a slide earlier, it's already up to $1.7 billion just in those 2 years. And there's no better way to address this problem than by funding asset preservation. We have about $200 million for asset preservation at state agencies that we were discussing a little bit earlier, Madam Chair. And it's important to remember that it's not just we think these are critical asset preservation projects to maintain, but it's not just our recommendation. As you know, I've mentioned this before, we're evaluated from the outside by credit rating agencies to the extent that we maintain and keep up with our infrastructure. Credit rating agencies at some point will determine that a state's failure to invest in its infrastructure becomes a credit risk. Now, we've been maintaining an investment history over the years, and I think we need to show that we're continuing to do that going forward, or we could run the risk at some point of not keeping up with our infrastructure. This is not a Minnesota problem unique to Minnesota. As we know, the entire country faces an extreme infrastructure problem, and so many, many states are in this position. And I think we need to be really cognizant of the fact that we will be evaluated based upon the investment that we have in our infrastructure. I'm going to go to the quality of life package unless there are any other questions about public safety.
I think before we go, we should talk about how your team discussed putting projects in as a result of one agency has regulation over another agency. But in public safety, it became very obvious as we were toured and it was mentioned. Department of Corrections have to certify that jails are up to code and built to code and so forth. And so Department of Corrections then has an effect on counties because the counties carry out, in many cases, the public safety of the people in the communities that are arrested and sentenced or arrested and held over or helped or whatever. And there are all kinds of state agencies that have recommendations for other state agencies. And then they, as they talked to us on our tour, was, well, this wasn't on our list, but now we have to do something because we're going to lose our accreditation in one more year or whatever, because if we haven't addressed this, it has to be done. And that comes with the environmental agencies also with their regulations for another agency. And can you share with us some of your experiences or discussions that took place and take place when very few things in the finance committee, various finance committees of those agencies don't address the costs of carrying out the dictates of their regulators?
Well, Madam Chair, that is something we need to be, I think, more cognizant of and address more often. The example that I would like to talk a little bit about is at the water treatment plant at Detroit Lakes. It's one that's just about ready to open. I've had the opportunity to be there twice, and once on our own we visited, and also with the governor. But what happened there was you had a situation where the Public Facilities Authority and the water standards from PCA and started getting more and more stringent and changing over time. And a lot of communities are addressing that change in the standards for their water quality. And it sometimes can be quite expensive. And so Detroit Lakes several years ago felt like they needed to address this, and they had phosphate level issues in their water. But they in fact, at the time that they embarked in their program several years ago, there was no known technology to get their water to the standard that they needed to get it to in terms of getting the phosphate out of the water. So they did some work and did some studying, and they came up with a proposal that was funded by state dollars, local dollars. Do you remember? There were some other dollars involved in that, I think. Local dollars were involved. So it was like over $40 million, I think $47 million or something dollars for that particular facility. And they, in the process, were able to come up with a new technology really based on the size of the filters. And they now have water that's almost drinkable when it comes out of their facility. But it's a state-of-the-art facility. And it shows, I thought it was a good example of showing how a community can rally around a problem and solve it by bringing in different partners, leveraging local money and state money. But it was a recognition that the standards have changed, and there are new challenges in our water quality. And if we don't step up and address those, just like in the other areas you mentioned. If we don't, as a policymakers, if we don't address the fact that we're imposing new standards or new requirements for other agencies or other cities and counties and figure out what that's going to cost, then we're going to have these situations where we lag behind and local communities struggle to catch up. So that was a success story. I mean, it's a story where a community was able to put together a project and get the project going. And I do remember standing, that particular project uses, as I mentioned, smaller and smaller filters to get the water clean, plus an aerobic tank and some other things. I do remember standing with the governor on the aerobic tanks, and I got a phone call standing out there on the tanks. I said, you know, Governor, I don't think I'm going to take this call right now. I didn't want to lose chance of losing my phone in that particular situation. But it was just a great example of how we work together to solve that problem. But I think there are built-in costs whenever we make decisions in terms of assets here in this body if we add new criteria or new conditions. And we oftentimes don't think about the downstream, pardon the pun, but the downstream costs and what that's going to mean for a county and a jail facility, for example, or a new standard in water quality. We do have long-term costs, and these are legitimate changes in standards, but we just have to figure out a way to fund those going forward, and we don't do that a lot. We do try to catch up to that, but we need to be much more proactive in how we fund for those changes. And
Representative Considine.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just wanted to go back to one thing that you said, which is that if we don't invest in the infrastructure, we could threaten that AAA bond rating. And even the slightest drop in that means ongoing an increase of millions, tens of millions of dollars of interest every time we have a bonding project. So it is incumbent upon us to take care of these things, if nothing else, to protect that bond rating. Otherwise, we'll have the citizens of Minnesota paying tens of millions of dollars every year extra to line the pockets of the people that issue the bonds. Thank you.
Commissioner, Ms. Connor, do you have any advice on how much guilt the Capital Investment Committee members should feel about this regulation and the lack of conversation in the Finance Committee about the guilt that they're passing on to us through the regulating process?
Well, Madam Chair, I'm not a religious person, so I don't deal in guilt a lot. I figure it's life's hard enough to add that level of stress. But it is important that we don't just kick the can down the road, which is what we've been doing by not funding, not funding capital investment enough over the last 10 years. When we've had this low interest rate environment, Representative Considine mentioned, we've just passed up some really unusual opportunities. We have an opportunity now, and I'll get more into it in just a minute, about how much money we can save or have saved. But it really is, if you don't pay it now, you will pay it later, and it will be more later on. So, I think the key is to really be committed to making sure that we keep Minnesota as a AAA state, maintaining, balanced budgets and also keeping our reserve full, which it is right now, but also making sure that we invest in capital investment at a level that makes a lot of sense. I know there's a debate about what that level is, but if we don't do that, then I think we should feel a little bit guilty that we're not doing the people's work.
Because on our tours, the community didn't mind giving us guilt. Even to the one stop that we made with the 15-year-old public safety facility that all of a sudden is obsolete. 15 years. I didn't accept much guilt on that one. Representative Salt.
Thank you, Ms. Chair. I had chatted with the commissioner about the concepts of lost opportunity and how that stress comes to me. And I was going to let it go and pass and say that, well, we're way too deep in the stuff right now to take this up. But then you said you're not religious and that there's elements of stress that you wanted to avoid talking about. And I want to layer on you then a piece of that stress, the way we deal with lost opportunity. Most of us think of it from the concept of being a business owner, like myself at one point. And I lost opportunity when I failed to go out and make a remodeling improvement on my building. My lost opportunity was that opportunity that I might have even increased my business by 50% of its size in terms of people assets coming in. The other loss of opportunity that I experienced was that the human beings under a circumstance where they can identify and feel the need for that capital improvement or that change of structure, maybe more employees. But the fact that that can't be changed and they don't have the power to change it, I have excised from them that power. I reserve that to myself as the owner. So we now have communities out there that come to us feeling like, and I was struck by this because it happened more than once, and all of a sudden my guilt, my religious guilt, layered onto me. And somebody said to me, can we present this correctly to be sure that you understand how important this is to us? They honestly believe that if they chose the right words, went to a consultant, similar to the young people sitting here that advise us daily, if we say this correctly, if somehow we can picture it correctly, we will then get what it is we need. They are giving themselves the weight of that responsibility. In mental health care, having somebody experience challenges and things that they have no power or access to change or improve is stress. It's one of the definitions, I believe, somewhere. And, you know, I'm an old man that maybe read this someday, and now I'm making up ways to attach it to things. But I believe that's somewhat true. All of us feel a accelerated amount of stress trying to do what we're supposed to do when we take away the ability to affect those changes. We sit around here, and I've sat here now for 3 years, and so I'm quite sure I at least understand it in that short term. We routinely remove the ability of members who are running their communities to fix the problems. They make these wonderful, beautiful pictures of what life could be, and we view it, and we ooh and ah, and we say how wonderful that is, and they start to get that warm feeling that you were talking about, and you, Ms. Chair, that you were talking about, that when we come to visit, they are buoyed up with the optimism that that problem is going to go away. Baloney. We routinely walk past these problems and say things like, well, we don't want to jeopardize our credit rating. We don't want to jeopardize the amount that we have in reserves. We don't want to jeopardize. We have a litany of excuses and reasons that they then have to listen to, and the stress weights them down. My sense is that lost opportunity can be enumerated in lots of different ways. So one would say that if you borrow a lot of money as a business, you are going to lose opportunity because you are going to bind your cash flow in such a way that you don't have the opportunity to move forward and through maybe problems that come forward. I can tell you there are days when I was working over the concept of should I borrow or should I not borrow for my building to become 50% bigger and all those kinds of things. Should I layer that drag on the work, the cash flow of this business because I want to increase the opportunity of this business to do what it's supposed to do? Well, we as a state do exactly that day after day after day when we go to the Minnesota Zoo and we say, oh, you know, that treetop thing is just a nice toy. It's a Disneyland thing. And so we're maybe not going to fund that sort of thing. Folks, I'm just trying to tell you that I am consumed by the stress of layering failure or layering continued stress on the citizens of Minnesota. We have people that we walked into their places and we could almost look across their small building that was their water plant and look at the pipes that were within 6 pounds of water pressure from just blowing out. And we know that they were in such horrible shape that they were, that destruction was imminent. And yet we walked through, smiled nicely, made believe that we were carrying in our satchel some solution, that sort of thing. And they may or may not end up being successful in this round robin, this randomness of, yeah, we'll choose that one, and no, we won't choose that one. Maybe we'll choose this one over here because Representative Erdahl is the representative in that district.
Of course.
And we won't do this one over here because that's in the district that Mr. Selk is in, and he's leaving. So that threat issue of his personality coming and looking me in the face and saying, why didn't you fix what's in my community, is going to get blown away. So I know I've ranted on. Most people can set me aside, and you're going to be able to do that soon. I just want you to carry with you that there is much greater impact on this constant going back to the same old whiny excuse that we don't have the ability to have the money. Baloney. We do have the ability to have the money. We just decide we don't want to. We're choosing which one of the drags we're going to live with. Are we going to live with the drag of 8 extra or higher interest rate cash flow, servicing the debt? Or are we going to carry the weight of communities across the state that will not realize their potential because they won't have gotten through the gauntlet, and that happens daily and routinely here? Thank you for listening. I am, as you can tell, I'm just distraught with this. And if nothing else, please change your methodology for my sanity. I will live better in retirement. Well, theoretically, retirement, people call it retirement. I won't be here. But I will live better when I see the state stepping up and actually doing these things, not letting some city, some small town that happens to be 10 miles north of the state's most energized fiscal economics that exist. There is an engine that's running that is just producing cash flow in so many different parts of the economy, and yet there is a group of about 200 people that are struggling with trying to figure out what they are going to do on behalf of their city for its sewer septic system. And they're between a fight of a big dog and a small dog, and it's all of that sort of stuff that we routinely go through. I don't know whether we're going to help them or not. What a set of stress. Think of the drag on those community leaders when they get up in the morning and go to their job, okay. Then they go to their city volunteer job, and they're struggling with, should we argue a different way? If we say it different, will then somebody from the state be able to pay some of this money that we need to have this thing? That is a false economy. That's an economy based on the overlord father. And I tell you, I tried to live that way when I had 2 children. Being an overlord type father sucks and will not work. Your kids will move past you in a minute, and they will move into the new and modern world. And I think we are holding back communities across the state by this false silliness of, oh, we can't find the money. We can. It is available. We have to structure differently, and we have to think differently. So thanks for your time, Chair. I know that you had no plan to listen to that.
Are you sure? Representative Juergens.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Commissioner Franz, in looking at the governor's recommendations, they fall into 5 categories for the GO bond. I'm curious if you could help shed some light on what criteria was used to qualify for public safety, for example. That seems to be the largest segment that's broken out here, and that's such a broad category. If you could just help us kind of walk through the thought process or the criteria used.
Sure, Madam Chair, Representative. I think one of the you know, the challenge of picking these buckets and these themes was trying to figure out where, you know, some of these things went. And the goal in public safety and asset preservation was to show the linkage between public safety and asset preservation on the one hand. For example, at corrections, I mean, clearly the asset preservation needs of the Department of Corrections are serious, they're longstanding, and they obviously have public safety components to them, as well as just hard, typical asset preservation needs. And so the goal was to show that asset preservation in many, many cases also becomes a public safety issue if not addressed on a timely basis. So that was part of the rationale in putting some of the public safety and asset preservation packages together. When Commissioner Harrington and Commissioner Anderson Kelleher describe in more detail the projects there, I think you'll see some of the more direct linkages. But that was the overall thinking, was let's try to think about this in a way. You know, there's some asset preservation in some other areas too, like water infrastructure. But this was really designed to have that combination of those factors that we think also affected one another.
Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And going back to Representative Sock's dissertation, I think he raised a lot of good points about asset preservation, and I appreciate the passion that he has. Just wanted to clarify one area for folks, and that is when we come into a district and we're going through a wastewater treatment plant or a water plant or something, it's not so much about, in most cases, about us deciding are we going to fund that or not, because we do have a system through PFA that rates these things. And we ask probably every time, where do you rank on the PFA list? And so what we are doing in the bigger sense of it is trying to determine if we have all of these projects that have a need, then how much does the total amount we put into PFA grow? And so, a lot of decisions we make may be fairly arbitrary, but there are some where we actually have a prescribed way of doing it.
Commissioner.
Madam Chair and Representative, I think that's a good point about the state programs, in particular PFA. In fact, in our materials, there's a list of the priority list of all those communities. You can see now they obviously have to complete the application and get everything done on time in order to get that money. But that, I think that's true of the local roads program, the local bridges program, the railway access or railway safety issues. We want to support whenever we can programs that really help people apply or communities apply, get in line, justify their need, and then get prioritized. I think that's a great way to do that. But from our point of view, many of the state programs like that provide that opportunity for people to see where they have an opportunity to get on the order of priority. Not everything's done that way, but that is one area that I think that is a good way to do it.
Madam Chair.
Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Commissioner Franz, of course, University of Minnesota, our college system also gives us a list of their priorities. So there are various areas where we do know.
Yes.
Thank you. Please continue, Commissioner.
Well, let's talk about this is the last package I'm going to talk about before we start talking about finances and money and to get to some of the issues raised. What can we afford and how do we address the debt service issue? So this last package is a little bit even more broad in the sense of we put many of our local projects for local communities was put here for like town halls, libraries, recreational trails, and transit, for example. One of these projects, for example, the city of Ellsworth, many of you know in Nobles County, they lost their city hall in the fire last January. And we've heard from residents in Ellsworth through our public comment webpage that they told us that they may be small, but they're mighty, and they really need our help to get that community back up to speed with state support for a construction of a new city hall. So there, that's a community of less than 500 people asking that we partner with them. You know, there's a big debate, and this category probably encapsulates that debate better than any of these categories, and that is the statewide regional importance and local community debate that we have about what should be in a statewide bonding bill. And I would just say, and I know the governor has talked about this many times, there are some times that these projects simply will not get done if the state doesn't step up to help. And so the question becomes, how are we going to, as a state, support the quality of life around Minnesota in such a way that provides these local communities the opportunity, whether it's for clean water or a new town hall after a fire or a new police station is in Virginia, I think it is. A new fire station in Virginia that's been there for like 100 years. How do we as a state step in to support some of these obviously local interest projects, but that have a profound effect and profound importance on their local community and their local support? So that's why this package is really designed to be pretty broad. We have $536 million in general obligation bonds in this particular category. About $265 million of the GO bonds are for local projects, and about $271 million are for state agencies. That's how that the 536 breaks up. We have about $50 million in user finance bonds in this category as well. As you know, the RFA, the Rural Finance Authority, uses a user finance bond to make those loans, that money available for loans to farmers. And also there's some user finance by Minnesota State for some of their projects. So these really, this category provides a lot of different opportunities to invest around the state of Minnesota. The governor and lieutenant governor also believed, as you can see from the circle up there, we included a $30 million equity investment. And part of this goes to some of the issues that you've all raised better than I could, and that is, how do we provide an opportunity for those communities and those projects that don't necessarily have the typical access to this process? And we wanted to work with this committee to provide an opportunity for these local projects that have an investment in equity that we think is important to come to this committee, provide their testimony and support for projects. We wanted to make sure, though, that we didn't just support an equity investment without setting aside $30 million in general fund cash to support those equity investments. So that's why we included $30 million here in an equity investment to give this committee and the legislature an opportunity to hear these programs, let these folks come forward, show that what their projects can do for their local communities. And the governor and lieutenant governor really encouraged nonprofit groups to bring their proposal to the legislature this session, and we would recommend that you would include, to the extent you can, or maybe you want to do more, at least $30 million in an equity investment. So that's still a process in development, working with Madam Chair, but we hope this is something that can really open up this process to those people who don't always necessarily see an opportunity to participate in this process.
Representative Lee.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Commissioner, too. And when we met in my office, I just want to say this for the committee, too. I'm really thankful for the investment that the governor and the lieutenant governor is putting into this equity funds. And when we often think about the communities that are impacted by some of our state investment or those who are not invested in, I think that we really need to focus, you know, our efforts on these communities that are oftentimes thought about being here in the metro area, but often more often than not, they are in greater Minnesota. And, you know, I still remember when Representative Vane and I, we traveled to Southwest Minnesota to Tracy, to Wanna Grove, and to Worthington, just to hear about some of these local requests from the community members and, you know, what they want to see from the state of Minnesota. I think that the investment that the governor has in the proposal is definitely needed. And I really appreciate under the proposal to also have a dedicated staff person to, you know, help these communities out with regards to how do they navigate the state bonding process so that we and our state dollars could reach out to every part of the state and to every community, whether that's, you know, our communities of color, disadvantaged communities, or our indigenous communities too. You know, having been up to the Northwest to talk to them about some of their needs and some of their requests, I really appreciate this and just want members of the committee to know how impactful the $30 million in requests that the administration will have for the state of Minnesota as we move forward. So I just want to say thank you.
Commissioner, I appreciate the $30 million too in cash, but I was thinking more like several hundred million.
Madam Chair, I know I'm falling short of your expectations. I know that. But, you know, it does go to what Representative Lee said, though, and that is that we just, the more we reach out, the more we engage more folks in this process, generally, the better it's going to be. The more opportunity we give people to who don't always participate, but it just makes for a better process. That's one of the reasons why the public comment on our website was such a great opportunity to, there were like, I mean, almost 1,600 comments. I read every single one of them, and they were really interesting and fun to read. And I just think that to the extent we reach out now to these nonprofits and give them an opportunity, the more we are able to connect with local communities and the people who are doing work on the ground there, knowing, understanding their community's needs. And also, I think we sometimes forget how effective and efficient nonprofits can be in delivering services or program. So I thank you for that support, Representative Lee, and we'll work with Madam Chair to get that right number in there. So let's talk about, how about capital budget financing? You've all, many of you have addressed this issue. So I want to break this down and talk a little bit about the GO bonds first, and then about the overall total financing, and then how we can afford this at this time. So this is what, you know, this is sort of the golden number. I mean, as you know, there are all kinds of different numbers in this bill. There's appropriation bonds, there's trunk highway bonds, and there's general obligation bonds. But we typically look at the general obligation bond as the sort of the big number that we're trying to decide, how much are we going to do here. I just wanted to show this slide to show you how we get to the little over $2 billion in general obligation bonds. As I went through those different areas, I mentioned the general obligation bonds in each one of those categories. There are obviously other investments I'll show you in just a moment. But this is how we divided up the $2.03 billion in general obligation bonds. Let me now show you the total financing package for this. So you can see at the top, the general obligations of 2.028. Now we have other financing, about $571 million. Now, not all of this is supported by the general fund, but we just wanted to show the breakdown. We've mentioned the $252 million in appropriation bonds. That includes the money for the housing infrastructure. But also, one of the things that we wanted to mention, as you asked a little bit earlier, Madam Chair, and that is the general obligation bonds are appropriate for some things, but in the housing area, this is one area where appropriation bonds are better used. We have user financing, as I mentioned, about $90 million, some for the Rural Finance Authority, and about $30 million for Minnesota State. We have trunk highway bonds, as I mentioned earlier, about $172 million for those very targeted projects. And we have the equity-focused cash investments that Representative Lee just asked me about, the $30 million. And we also have about $26 million in state agency project cash, and that is used for those situations where, you know, there might be equipment or there might be some problem with using general obligation bonds. So we use the $26 million to finance some of those. There's a revolving loan fund for energy efficiency projects at the state level that we use, for example, early childhood center renovations. So those are the cash is for those particular projects that don't qualify for general obligation. So we get to the $2.599 billion is the overall package for the in total governor's package. But let me talk, unless you have a question, I want to talk about how we can afford this. So we know that the general obligation portion of this request over the next 3 years will cost about $181.6 million. So that is adding the money in the first year in fiscal 21 and then 22 and 23. The appropriation bonds, also supported by the general fund, are shown here, a little over $5 million for the first several years and up to $13 million in 23. So it's an additional $23 million. And the general fund cash this year, we're recommending $56 million in total and just a small amount in earlier years. So that's another $56 million. So the total general fund cost of this additional bonding request above and beyond what we forecasted is $261.4 $4.6 million over the next 3 years. Obviously, the funding of this goes beyond that point, but I'm just showing what we're budgeting for the next 3 years. The trunk highway bonds, on the other hand, are a separate category and funded by the trunk highway funds. So that shows you the before we say why borrow now, any questions on those numbers before I talk about why we can afford those? So, you know, we believe, and the governor is strong in believing that we can afford these investments now. And to Representative Sock's comments earlier, this is really an opportunity to preserve and renew many of the assets that we've already, that have been here for a long time, or maybe some of these are new, but there really are investments in safe and affordable housing, water quality and infrastructure, higher education, public safety, asset preservation, and repairs. And this, all of these categories only become more expensive in the future. During my time as Commissioner of Minnesota Management and Budget, we have worked to govern in a fiscally responsible manner. With 8 years now of balanced budgets, a full rainy day fund, a AAA credit rating, and low interest rates, we believe that we can afford a robust capital budget bill that is below our state debt limits, and I'll show you that in just a moment. But for example, in last August, we completed a $662 million sale of general obligation bonds. The interest rates that we were able to capture were equal or better than the AAA Municipal Market Fund. That means we outperformed the AAA states in this fund level. We had 1.17% for some of our bonds and another group a little over 2%. Those are phenomenal interest rates to be borrowing at this time. And the interest rate environment continues to be good in this area. Minnesota bonds sell very, very well. And that's in part because we've managed our state debt. We see that people see the AAA credit rating. You know, one of the things that happens, as Representative Considine mentioned earlier, is that if the interest rates had been higher, so let's assume that the interest rates, instead of getting 1.17 and 2% last August, let's assume that they were 3.1%, which they were in 2018. We would have spent $48 million more in interest alone just for that sale. So just for one sale in August of 2019, we saved over $48 million from what would have happened the previous year because of the low interest rates. That's real money that we can now use for this particular project. So the other thing that I want to also mention is I want to show you the credit debt guidelines that we have. We have three of them. We've been through this many times, but we are in compliance with all three of them, and we have been throughout my tenure as Commissioner of Minnesota Management and Budget. The first guideline talks about the total tax-supported principal outstanding as a percent of personal income. So these are bonds we've actually sold, and the threshold is 3.2% of state total personal income, which is about $345 billion a year right now. So we are currently at 2.26, well below this guideline. These guidelines were adopted back in 2008, 2009, in part because this is the way the rest of the world looks at your debt. They look at your debt compared to your ability to pay, and that's one of the ways you have ability to pay is how much personal income do you have in the state. Guideline two is the total amount of tax-supported principal, both issued and authorized, but unissued as a percent of personal income. This, as you know, we don't always sell all the bonds in August. We only sell the bonds for the amount of money, that cash flow that we actually need. So this guideline gets to the total amount of authorized debt that we have, and that obviously the threshold's a little higher. It's 6%, and we're at 3.51%. And the third guideline shows that our debt should have no less than 40% of these bonds should be scheduled to mature within 5 years, and 70% should be scheduled to mature within 10 years. Well, we have now 42% are scheduled to mature within 5 years and 73% within 10 years. This is what gives the legislature flexibility to continue to bond every year. By managing this when they're paid off, it gives flexibility to you all to decide how much debt to add. One of the things that we now know is that the budget, the bonding bill that the governor is recommending would not threaten any of these guidelines by any stretch. Let's talk a little bit about how we can afford it. The rating agencies are learning and try to compare states to one another. That is sort of their big parameter, and it's hard to do. States have different kinds of debt. They pay it off in different ways. So this is not from MMB. This is from Moody's in 2019. They're trying to compare the debt service to revenues. So this shows you what percentage of the annual state debt service and what percentage that is of the total non-dedicated general fund revenues for each state. And it shows you that Minnesota has about a 3.3% debt service based on its total non-dedicated general funds. The amount of debt service each year is, I think for 2020, it's $540 million. That is 3.3% of the total non-dedicated general fund revenues. You can see here that we're, and you want to be on the left side of this column or this chart. So we're clearly on the left side. We're below the state, the U.S. median, but we have a really good comparison when you talk about debt service to revenues. And I will tell you that we could increase this year pretty substantially and not change our ranking here very much. These are big numbers involved here. We would have to go on a campaign of 2 to 3 to 4, 5 years of spending way above our normal spending amounts to get us to move up this chart to the right. So we've maintained a modest debt level. We can take advantage of that this year in particular. Let me talk about the total debt now. So if you go to the next, this is debt, general fund debt compared to personal total personal income. As I mentioned before, the total personal income in Minnesota this year is about $345 billion. So here you can see that we are right in the middle of the pack. Our total debt is about 2.6% of that $345 billion. And the median for the states is about 2.2. So we're right close to the median. Once again, right in the middle of the pack, which is exactly where you want to be. And again, it would take several years of concerted effort of a lot of investment, way beyond our normal investment in GO bonds to get to move up that chart very far. So we wanted to make sure that you saw the way that other agencies or credit rating agencies look at our debt and how they compare us to other states. We're here. I think it's a good place to be, but it also gives us an opportunity to take advantage of low interest rates and maintain our modest debt compared to other states. I'm going to make one final comment. We'll open it up for questions, some more questions. We all know every year projects get more expensive. If you think your roof's starting to leak now, just think what it's going to be like in a year. And mine did that this last year. I came home one night. It wasn't the roof. It was the bathroom on the third floor. It was leaking. And I got to my bedroom, and I heard this. I thought, what the heck is that? It was water dripping onto my bed from the bathroom upstairs. Well, you know, it costs a lot of money to fix that. It would have been better if I would have thought, you know, maybe I should fix that old bathroom up there before. But I didn't, and I paid a pretty extreme price to get that cleaned up. So, you know, we all know it's going to get more expensive, and we all know we have an opportunity to borrow at really low rates right now, and we really recommend that we take that opportunity. But it's not like we're doing it just because we think it's a good idea to borrow money at low interest rates. We have really good projects, and time and time again, the governor has been really clear, and the lieutenant governor, they've all been out and reviewed these projects, and what they're banking on is that collectively we put together bills that have really smart projects that need to get done, that support our state agencies, that support our universities and colleges, support local communities, and get these investments done. We believe, you know, when I step back and look at sort of the critical questions for me are, do the projects need to be done? Number two, do we have the resources to afford the increased debt service? Number three, will this proposed maintain our AAA credit rating? And number four, will this proposal support Minnesotans across the state? So as we get ready, and the session kicks off today, as we get ready and look to the forecast in later in February, we'll see where we are with the $1.3 billion surplus we currently have for this biennium. We'll see where that comes out. But based on the current resources, we believe that we have the resources to invest in the governor's package. We're recommending this package, Madam Chair and members, because this is what we've done with our due diligence. We look forward to working with this committee and looking at other projects that are going to come and be heard and come to an agreement on how best to make this work for Minnesotans. And I think the governor, and one of his real encouraging signs was to go around and look at projects before we made the recommendations, which is kind of a gutsy thing to do because you don't know whether that project he's visiting may or may not be in the final bill. But it was really an example of his commitment to hearing from people, listening to them at the local levels about what do they need, how can we work together, and if we don't do this in a fair way across the state of Minnesota, then we're really losing an opportunity to do our jobs from the governor's perspective. So thank you, Madam Chair and members, for letting me and Ms. Connor come and talk today, and we're happy to take even more questions.
Representative Dean.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Commissioner, and thanks for the thorough presentation. I looked at a few areas of this in some detail, and I look at the housing portion. And with a 300,000 unit need of affordable housing over the next 10 years, I did some math, and maybe I shouldn't be doing math, but if you could build those units at $150,000, which you can't, and if the state picked up 15% of that cost to spur that private development, that would be $6.75 billion over those 10 years. And what you're proposing falls way short of $675 million a year. So I'm concerned as we think about the future, what that looks like. And it's clearly one of those things that the building profession, along with the state, along with other banking institutions or whatever it is, needs to be part of a solution, because we know that when someone is not housed, when they're going through difficult times, whether they're in shelters or whether they're homeless, they ultimately cost the state a whole lot more money than those units would cost. So I think we need to think about the severity of the problem of affordable housing. And I think when you talk to a lot of employers, those employers will say one of the most important needs they have, especially in areas of greater Minnesota, is accessibility for housing for their employees. I realize there's only so much we can do with the bonding bill. We can't do everything with it. So that was one of my concerns. The other concern that I have is about transportation costs and how we're funding our roads. We know that previously we'd taken out a large part of money that went into the state general funds for the auto part sales tax. And that creates a little bit of a hole to help pay for the roads that we've yet been able to pay for through user fees and gas taxes. So when I look at this and when I think of the highway trunk bonds and all those other types of things, I think about them not in isolation, but in the context of what we're doing in other areas of our budget as well. And I think we need to be honest with Minnesotans about what we're doing sometimes when we're robbing Peter to pay Paul, which we have a tendency to do here at the Capitol. You know, this isn't the first time it happened. I'm sure it won't be the last time that has happened. But as needs shift, we'll have to consider that. And I just want to thank my colleague, Representative Salk, for his comments, because this is real. And when you look at those people in those communities in their eyes, they need help. And we can't help all of them. And that's a tough place for all of us to be. And, you know, I commend the chair for taking on such a massive responsibility. And I know we have a couple of the previous chairs here. Saying no to people when it's a critical part of their lives and their cities and the way in which they live is probably one of the hardest things we have to do. So thanks for the thorough presentation. Really appreciate it.
Representative Salk.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If I could get your attention, Commissioner, to the debt capacity guideline sheet that you use. And an old farm kid that grew up in the 50s sort of needs to put some different grab posts in this thing so I can understand where the risk arrives and where the relationships matter or should be seen as risky. So like in the first one, we have a differential between 3.25 and 2.26. And I used to be a student of the real estate market in Rochester for about 25, 30 years. And I knew in gathering enough money or gathering enough data points over a long period of time, I got to a point where I could almost look at the data points on any given day and tell people, we are on the road to real challenges and problems, or to tell people, We are in great times now, and it is going to continue because it had done so historically a number of times in repetition. And we all think, oh, but what if the bad day comes? Oftentimes, if you see a long enough string of historical data points, you know the risk of what a negative will be. Not that it is that all of a sudden you plunge to dead zero. It's that you just get a little too tight on your margins. So help me understand what this margin actually means, because if it's been 2.27 for the last 6 years, and now it's 2.26 in a relationship to 3.25 now, but maybe was 4 at a different date, that sort of thing. This right here, unfortunately, I haven't been around here long enough to see a series of about 20 of these, but I'm suspecting somebody here has and is either creating and or looking at these to provide themselves guidance. So could you give me some sense of a historic range, whether you do it in the form of the mode of the differential or the range of the differential and how fast it moves over time?
Madam Chair, Representative, well, it's a great question, and it does not move a lot very fast because, as you can imagine, it takes some pretty big numbers to move this thing around. But it has been increasing slightly up until about several years ago, and the last several years it's been decreasing slightly. So what we're seeing is that maybe about 4 or 5 years ago we had some bigger bonding bills, and it started going up a little bit to, I think, maybe, I don't think it hit 3%. But what's happened since, though, as our economy continues to grow, the 3.4, it was only a few years ago they were under $300 billion. So as our total personal income in the state goes up, this percentage has gone down because we haven't been maintaining commensurate bonding bill debt at the same time. So our with this numbers, the 2.26% has been falling slightly over the last several years. Now, let me give you a different way to look at it, though. So this also, we try to measure this over, I think we have to project over 6 years, 4 or 6 years, 6 years in the future, how this is going to go forward. Now, the way we do that is we take historically what we've done in the past. And the historical average over the last 10 years is about $755 million on a bonding year, or an even year, as they say, and about $265 million on a budget year. So that's the number that we look going forward. If we maintain the assumption, what would happen? But we've also looked at this number and said, well, what if we did what size of a bonding bill could we do this year and still keep below the guideline number one is the most sensitive one that we have. And we've come up with around $3.5 billion. This, put out a $3.5 billion bonding bill this year, that threshold would not hit that threshold. It'd be close. So, but then we also have to assume what would happen in years going forward. That gets a little dicier. So, but assuming that we had a $3.5 billion bonding bill this year, we'd be right at the 3.25%. That's sort of the amount of play involved there. Now, if you go down to guideline number three, that, as you can tell, if you did a big bonding bill this year, you might change the mix some of the 5-year, 10-year maturity. So if you had anything over a $2.3 billion bonding bill this year, then you would have to adjust the date some, because that guideline wouldn't be the same if you went over a $2.3 billion bonding bill this year. So you can see these all have different variances in terms of when the threshold is hit and it hits the guideline limit. Does that help any?
Yes. Thank you very much. That very much does help. Although I still lack the benefit of having lived for the last 13 to 15 years watching this, you know, and I know she's probably hidden someplace. You have that data. It's very difficult when you're trying to make judgments like we are here and use something that's a single data point when you have none of the reference points that are there for you. One of the other things I was just curious about, if I can ask one more question, Madam Chair, the impact of the private economy, which is about as random as I think any of us could imagine on any given stretch of time, because there's all kinds of things wrapped in there. There's federal tax policy that's wrapped in, and there's
political impact, and so we end up with these. But the amount of debt being carried in the private sector by persons and the amount of debt being carried by commercial business operations, I think they would also be indicators of how is cash flow moving through the economy. And if you understood what I said, it's why I need somebody to answer, because I don't understand what I just said.
Madam Chair, Representative, well, I think the best way that I can look at it is that, I mean, obviously the total debt in our society, both in individuals and businesses and state governments, are critical. But one of the things that I sort of look at is this decision is not unlike when you want to buy a car or buy a home. What is your monthly income? How much money do you bring in on a regular basis? And how much can you leverage that? So really what we're saying here, in a way, is that we can leverage about $128 million over the next $182 million in the next 3 years. We can leverage that money to invest about $2.45 billion in capital investments. So the risk is that we'll have an economic downturn and we won't have that revenue stream in the future. That's one of the reasons you want to have a full budget reserve that we do. But that is the risk the state runs, is that eventually there'll be a economic downturn and the amount of the debt will go up as a percentage of your general fund revenues. And so that's I think, the key is that we have to feel comfortable that this state is doing well, will continue to do well, and can afford that debt service.
Representative Juergens.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I just got one of my questions answered by Mr. Lee, so I'll skip that one. But the other question, Commissioner Franz, has to do with the debt that's retiring this year. You know, we're retiring debt as we take on additional debt. Can you give us some idea with this proposal by the governor of just over $2 billion, will the state of Minnesota be in more debt or less debt when you take into consideration any debt that we are paying off or retiring?
Madam Chair, Mr. Representative, I don't have that in front of me, but I'll get that for you, for the committee, to show. I don't think that the debt payoffs or cancellations exceed what we're doing, but I'll get that chart to show. So you want to know what kind of debt is being retired or canceled too, I assume, but retired compared to how much new debt we're taking on?
Yes, Madam Chair.
I don't have that. I'll get that for you.
And Commissioner, yeah, okay, you understand the question. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Commissioner. I'm glad that you gave the summarizing numbers up to numbers that I've been frequently using. And so there's movement. There's room for movement. And, of course, and there's still, in addition, the cash amounts. And I imagine we can't talk about that really seriously until after the forecast comes out. But we have room to consider. And you've given us a lot of things to continue to think about and to weigh in our decisions. And we appreciate this. And we know you will be on call.
Yeah. Madam Chair, thank you for this opportunity. I'm always available to all of you. And I appreciate the interest. Thank you.
Thank you. And thank you, Ms. Connor, very much. And we will be continuing the discussion for the next few meetings, of which there are going to be several, and there will be several that are not yet on the agenda. So that being said, I just have one more announcement. There were over 75 people here at this meeting at one time or another today, and many of you have made calls for appointments. And appointment time during the day is very limited. So if you're on the list that Mr. Lincheski is keeping for people that need appointments, if you're on the list tomorrow, Wednesday, starting at 4 o'clock, and going to 8:30, 9 o'clock, we could have appointments during that time period. I appreciate very much the agency commissioners that have accepted our invitation to come from 4 o'clock on, or 3 o'clock on to date for appointments into 9 o'clock this evening. So I appreciate that very much, and ask you to continue to stay if you wish. This meeting is adjourned.